Good afternoon. In my presentation, I will talk about UMLSim, simulated based on user mode Linux. And I will start with a little overview of what it is. Then I will talk about some technical issues, and I will finish with a usage example. Okay, now on what it actually is. It's a simulation environment that you can use for the Linux kernel. You can run kernel code in this environment, and you can run applications under it. It's based on the real kernel code as of user mode Linux, so there hardly any modifications to this. And you can just use any application that actually runs under UML, so you don't need to recompile, you just use the same binaries. And the components of UMLSim are, first of all, an addition to UML to introduce virtual time. In simulations, it's interesting to be able to control the flow of time so that your simulation becomes deterministic. For instance, that you can say, I want to wait for 1 hour, and then the simulation can see, I can just, whenever a timer is being scheduled, I can just advance time to that time. When the timer is due, pop it, continue until I've reached my 1 hour goal, and then I come back to the simulation script and get new instructions. And in the other end of the range, you could also do things like simulate very high-speed networks with really tiny time increments that are actually not possible on the machine that you have because it's maybe too slow. And also that it's important that you have virtual time. So this is one part. And the other part is a control system that attaches to the UML system or to several UML systems. And it acts like a debugger to them. You can basically do all the things that you can do with GDB, like look at variables, change variables, set breakpoints, make functions return, call functions, and so on. And last but not least, there's a scripting language that is similar to C and Perl that controls all of this. It's a bit slow today. as I mentioned, there's this debugger functionality. So, can I actually move this microphone? Probably not. Okay, so there's several perspectives that you can take and things that you can do with this. First of all, as in most classical simulations, you can just look at the system from the outside and you can just observe it. Let's say you have two UML systems and you simulate a network between them. Then you can watch the packets go by. This is basically what TCP/DM does. Now, sometimes you want to manipulate things. So in this example, you could, for instance, introduce a link that has actually specific loss characteristics or the specific delay characteristics. So that a simulation takes an active role in actually influencing what is happening. Now, what is kind of new with UMLSim with respect to other more classical simulators is that you can also look into your system. So again, you might just want to observe things. Let's say you do a data transfer and you just want to see how TCP is doing. You look at all the state variables of your TCP on the sending or the receiving side and just record them. But you can also go much further. You can change the course of action in your code, in your kernel. And for instance, you might want to experiment with some code changes in your system. So what you can do is you set a breakpoint at the code that you're actually wanting to change. And when this code is reached, your simulation script takes over. Then you can do all the things that you want to do instead of the original code. And you just make this function return then after you're done. So you can actually experiment with small code changes without actually needing to recompile your kernel. This is particularly interesting if you have a set of changes and you want to try some combinations of them. Then you don't need to build 1,000 kernels with a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But you can just switch it on in your simulations. Now to the historical background of all this. It all started with TCNG. I'm not sure if you're familiar with traffic control, or network traffic control in Linux. There's this nice utility called TC. Has anyone of you ever used TC? Okay, so I'm sure you liked it. It's nice and user friendly, and people have grown a lot of gray hair over this. So once I thought it would actually be nice to have something a little bit more convenient, and so I wrote a program that takes a nice description of the traffic control configuration in a, also again kind of a C-like syntax, and converts this to TC. Now, one of the problems with this is that there are lots of little parameters that go into this, a lot of individual elements that need to be configured, they need to interact in some specific ways, and so on. So how can I be sure that everything actually works, and that it also yields the same results? So what I did was that I wrote a simulator that takes the traffic control code of the kernel, plus some configuration interfaces. It takes the configuration utility, and it merges that code, adds a bit of glue code, and also a very simple scripting language to run all of this. And this is pretty useful. I'm using this in a lot of regression tests in TCNG. There are about 1,500 regression tests on TCNG at the moment. And unfortunately, there's a little problem with this. And that's that the extraction process for TC sim is actually, well, it has a lot of knowledge about the kernel code. It knows, okay, if I want to extract this part of functionality from the code, I go to this function, then I continue till I see this specific comment, then I stop extracting, then I skip a little bit ahead, and then when I see those parentheses in the right place, then I resume, and so on. So the effect is that, unfortunately, every once in a while, usually whenever there's a new release of the 2.4 kernel, TC sim breaks the extraction process of it, so I need to update it. And this would have been a fairly major nightmare also for 2.6 to convert it. And yeah, as I said, I've written it for 2.4, so 2.6 would have been a completely new affair. So I thought, okay, it works in 2.4, that's nice. But for 2.6, I don't want to go through the same procedure again. And actually, it would be so much nicer to have a simulator that can do more than this. Not just play with the networking code, with the traffic control subsystem, but rather do anything in the kernel. So I want the idea of extracting things, but rather just take the entire kernel and make it do what I want and use the entire kernel in my simulations. So some reasons for using simulations. Well, first of all, there are some advantages over real-life tests. Real-life tests, when you take the boxes, configure them, interconnect them physically, and so on. First of all, the tests are deterministic and nicely reproducible, unlike real-life sometimes. You can experiment with very large systems, particularly for network simulations. It's not too uncommon to do simulations where you have hundreds of thousands of nodes, and you wouldn't really want to build a lab with all of this. And in particular, you wouldn't want to configure this lab. Then you can experiment with hardware that actually doesn't exist. For instance, it would be sometimes interesting for protocol design to experiment, say, with terabit networks. Well, unfortunately, you can't go just to the shop and buy a terabit card, but maybe in a few years you can. But so in a simulation, you can already set up things like that. And usually the setup overhead of simulations is pretty low, in particular because you can put everything in a script, so you don't have to go from machine to machine, type in commands, and check all the wires and all of this. There are unfortunately also some disadvantages. First of all, simulations are never perfectly correct. There's always something that they're missing, something that they're oversimplifying. Also, there might be other factors in the surrounding physical world that would affect a certain experiment, which are not present in a simulation. Sometimes they can also be slower than real life, particularly if you, say, try to simulate some very fast devices. Then the simulation system, with its added overhead, might actually make things slower than you would get it in a real-life experiment. And last but not least, you need to model some components in your system. For instance, if you want to simulate a network, you need to have models for network elements like routers, links, and all of this. if you wanted to simulate, say, some I/O subsystem performance, then you might have a model for your disk devices. So you need to construct these modules, and this usually takes a bit of time to get this right. Now, what you can do with those simulations? First of all, you can write regression tests, and that's really handy. You have a really complicated program, you make a few changes, and sometimes you're not quite sure if they're really good or not. Then you run your regression tests, and they will usually tell you how well you've done. Similar to this are the component tests, if you just want to look at specific parts of your system. For this, it's particularly interesting that you are capable of really going into your code with the debugger type of functionality. Because let's say you want to test certain failure patterns. Does the right thing if kmalloc fails? Or does this code the right thing if a disk error occurs? It's really hard to generate this in real life, while if you can actually go into the code, set your breakpoint there, make this function return an error code, then you can actually test this type of things. Another use is the validation of configurations. Sometimes you have complicated configuration scripts that set up something, and maybe you have to go to a specific site even for those things. This is quite common again in network testing and so. And that's nice if you can test those things offline on your own machine, and then you take it to the actual site, and your configuration scripts will already be correct and tested. Something that's also important is the demonstration of bugs. Sometimes you have really complicated code in the kernel, and you see, this looks kind of fishy. And you play a bit with it, and maybe you can even crash things. But of course, you could never really reliably use this. And it might take a while to actually convince other people that there's really a bug. Now, with a simulation, you can just make things occur in the right order, so this bug actually gets triggered. This is very useful. There's no denying that there's a bug when you can actually show it happening. And last but not least, for all kinds of performance measurements, again, you can, for instance, look at the memory impact of some operations, count all the kmallocs and the kfrees, and then see is this code actually, say, leaking memory, is it using absurd amounts of memory that you didn't expect, this type of things. Now, how does UMSSIM relates to other simulators? But first of all, one of the fun aspect that is very important is that UMSSIM is not limited to a single environment. There are lots of simulators that for specific areas of the system. For instance, there's the very well-known NS2 simulator by LBL and others, which is extremely popular for TCP/IP research. And unfortunately, it only simulates networks, so you couldn't use it, say, to simulate things in your I/O subsystem, block devices, and such. Then another important issue is that the UMSSIM uses exactly the normal kernel code, so you don't need to create an abstract model of the thing that you're actually trying to simulate and written in the simulation language of some other system. It also reduces the opportunities for creating model errors. It's not entirely impossible to do them, but at least since you have to do less kind of manual work when setting up a simulation, there's also less probability for errors. In particular, you don't need to model parts that are already there in the kernel. Like, for instance, again, network simulation, you usually have a model for TCP, which isn't exactly what Linux TCP does, but it's kind of close. All TCPs are sort of similar, but they're not identical. So if you wanted to make things work more closely to what the Linux kernel does in, let's say, NS2, then you would have to modify the internals of NS2, and you would quite likely introduce bugs by doing this. And yes, the big thing is that you don't need to translate your code back and forth, because it's the same code base, so you make a change, and it's in the real code that you're running, that you intend to use in real life, and it's in your simulation. So you don't need to go take your code, write something in a simulation language, run it in your simulation, see, okay, that's something not so good. Then figure it out what you have to change it in the simulation, see that it actually works, and then go back with your change to the original code and implement this change in C again. It's again a nice way of introducing errors. If you are missing, this doesn't happen. There's also a slight advantage, and that's because UMSM is so generic, it's actually pretty hard to optimize. Other simulators like NS2, it's much easier to optimize them. There's still some areas where UMSM can be improved, so I'm hoping that it will be not too catastrophically slower than specialized simulators, but it will certainly never be able to perform as well speed-wise as specialized simulators. There are some similar projects. There's one simulator for FreeBSD. It's called the TCTUNS, a networking simulator. It's a little bit similar to UMLSim, only that they change actually the kernel that is running on the live systems. So essentially they're kind of partitioning it into the kernel that is keeping the machine alive, and the parts of the kernel that are actually using in their tests. While UMLSim is a little bit better off because it's running in UML, so you can even crash your system in your simulation. That's fine. The host machine doesn't go down. And there's another one that's called Revert. This is used by a project at the University of Michigan, where they're looking at ways for finding for tracing back, for instance, intrusions into systems. So what they do is that they log the system activity at instruction level granularity, and they can replay this. It's also something very interesting, and so I would also like to do something a bit in this direction later on with UMLSim. Okay, now on to the technical details. Here's a little overview of a system with UMLSim. Like a spider in the center of the web, there's the actual simulator that controls everything. It is being directed by a script. Then it acts as a debugger to either entire UML systems, the big gray bubbles, or it can also be like a debugger towards other processes. Essentially, you can run any process under this system, just like you would run on the GGB. Now, in the UML systems, there are several components. I'm using the old style tracing thread version of UML. So there's a tracing thread, which is basically a coordinator for the whole system. And then there's several processes in there. One is the idle task, and the other processes for the actual applications, and they're also running kernel code. And then I'm adding another process, which is the UMLSim idle task, which is running at a priority, I forgot, is it above or a little bit below the idle task, which is also receiving directly messages from the simulator, so I don't have to go, it's just a more efficient communication mechanism. Because normally UMLSim interacts with the UML system using ptrace, and ptrace can be a little bit slow at times, particularly with UML. And so I have a shortcut there. Now, as you can see, there are multiple UML systems under the UML simulator, and it coordinates the activities of all of them, and sometimes it also takes care of, say, exchanging data between them. This is up to the implementation of the model and how you set up your script. Now, one of the more interesting features is the virtual time concept. It's implemented like this. First of all, UMLSim intercepts all the time-related functions in the kernel, like doGetTimeOfDay, getTimeOfDay, doTimer. And it makes sure that time only advances under the control of UMLSim. So this means while the kernel is doing something, time stands still. So you basically get something like an infinitely fast CPU. And when the kernel is idle, then it calls a function called UMLSimIdle. That sends a message to the simulator and indicates also when the next timer in the system will expire. Basically, when the system has to wake up again. At that time, UMS team also makes sure that all the soft interrupts and read copy updates and all those things have been executed. So the system is really idle until this timer expires. Then it waits until all the kernels in the simulation have become idle. If one of them, say, hits a breakpoint or something and some other activity is required, then UMS team may wake up the other kernels again to let them process any changes that have occurred, and then waits again till they become idle. Now, when all the kernels are finally idle, it picks the soonest event that is there, the next timer in any of the kernels, or a timeout set in the simulation script. And this becomes the new time, and this gets distributed to all of the kernels. And then they continue and may pop timers. And then again, the cycle repeats. You can see this a little bit better, perhaps, in the following picture. We have two kernels here, and at the beginning, both of them are running. UMS simulator is waiting for them to become idle. So first, the first kernel becomes idle, sends the idle message, indicates when it wants to run again, and stops. Now the second kernel is still running a little while, and then it hits a breakpoint. So it tells the simulator, I've reached that breakpoint. Now, perhaps we want to do something at this after this breakpoint. For instance, we might want to read some variables and modify things. Let's say this would be something in, again, in networking simulation, where you actually want to send a packet from one machine to the other. So you would read the packet, say, from the kernel 2, and then copy it into kernel 1. So when all of this is done, the simulator continues. It tells the second kernel just to continue. And it tells the first kernel that the time hasn't changed, and again, that it should please continue. So they are running again. Now, after a little while again, the first kernel becomes idle, tells the simulator, I'm idle, I'd like to run time 1.2, and waits for news. Now, also the second kernel becomes idle, sends the idle message. Simulator now has all the systems idle, so it can pick the next time, which in this case would be time 1.2. It distributes this to the two kernels and lets them run again. And the cycle repeats over and over and over again. Now, on the scripting language, well, there are several goals in there. First of all, it should be easy to learn to use for Linux programmers, so it should look a bit like C, preferably. Also, in your simulation, you might have actual kernel codes and script code that are sort of merged. The idea is that sometimes you want to replace functions from your kernel, and it's nice if you can just copy and paste them from your kernel, and they will still work or need almost no changes when you put them in your simulation script. So that's why I introduced some elements of Perl, for instance, to make variables look a bit different so there are no conflicts. Now, furthermore, there are some simulation-specific things that are needed in this system. There are kind of language extensions, if you want. And they include strings, associative arrays, processes as a first-class data type, also breakpoints, and some primitives for time and execution control. Also, in your simulation script, you can use types, functions, and variables from the actual processes that you're controlling. So you can, for instance, just call kernel functions. You can look at all the kernel variables. Plus, you get all the structured types and so on. UMSSIM extracts all this information from the debugging information that is generated by GCC, if you compile with -G. Now, in order to make it possible to use this for many different types of environments, I've chosen an extensible modular design where many of the not so low-level things are implemented in libraries, and only the most basic things are actually part of the language. Those libraries are just include files, but they're not too big, so you don't lose much time by not having them pre-compiled. On this picture here, you have the structure of those libraries. First of all, you have the language primitives. And on top of this, you have one set of libraries that provide some language extensions, like string functions, access to CPU registers, some wrapper functions for actually executing things. Then there's some general helper functions that just implement common concepts, like certain kernel functions, things like queues, that kind of stuff. Then there's subsystem-specific helper functions that provide interfaces to, for instance, networking subsystems, so they have functions for handling socket buffers, functions for inserting a tap into your internet interface so you get the packets that go there, or the functions to inject packets. On top of this, you have kind of the high-level subsystem interface. So it's, for instance, for the networking simulations, you have the NetSim kind of module. And these also implement at least part of the modules, or give you the primitives for implementing the modules. And then, of course, on top of this, you have the simulation scripts that set up the actual simulation environment, put all the pieces together, and run your tests in this. Here's some code example. The classic C for Fairtostiness. As you can see, all the variables begin with dollar signs, like in Perl. You have all the language constructs that you know from Perl or C. Almost all. There's still go to and do while are missing. I'm in the process of adding them. But you have for, if, switch, you have printf, you have all the usual operators. You even have octal numbers, as you can see on the last line. And something that's a little bit different is that functions basically done in a way that's similar to Lisp's lambda functions. So what you do is that a function is actually a first class data type, and you assign it to a variable. And then you call this. The advantage of doing things like this is that I don't need to have anything that's resembling function pointers in that language. So function and function pointers are basically the same thing. Here's another little example of a feature that's interesting in the simulation language, because in many cases you want to just monitor a system, look at some variables in the system, or even some data structures. And it would be inconvenient if you had to go through a large structure and print out tons of fields, write hundreds of printf statements or even loops just to extract the data. So there's a smart print function. And here in this example, what this example does is that it fires up a Linux kernel. It puts a breakpoint at the register netdef function and lets the kernel run till it hits the breakpoint. And then this script prints the device structure that is passed to the register netdef function. So if your kernel is registering the loopback device, then you get an output that looks like the blue part on the slide. you get, for instance, the name field. UMSM realizes, okay, this is a signed character array, so let's print this as a string. Then you get some integers. They print decimal and hexadecimal. Then it sees an unsigned char array. Okay, this is probably something that's kind of binary data, so it generates a hex dump. It goes into structures, prints the elements, and if it finds an enumeration type, then it prints the name. And it gets all this information from the debugging data that is generated by the compiler. Now let's look at some real-life usage. This is basically how UMLSim takes over the networking code. The typical flow of execution is that when sending a packet, the defqxmit function is called, which calls the queuing disk function, qdisk run and qdisk restart to actually see if there are any packets that can be put on the wire. If qdisk dq, the dq function, specific queuing disciplines are basically just queues. And so if this one returns a packet to be sent, then the stack calls the hard start xmit function of the device driver, of the network interface driver, And this one then stops the queue, puts the packets somewhere to the, on the hardware. And then when the packet has been sent or has been accepted by the hardware, then again the driver is called, then it wakes up the queue again and frees the buffer for this packet. Then the packet travels over to the remote machine, and over there you get an interrupt, and the driver receives the packet, allocates some buffer space for it, puts the data there, and calls the stack, the NetIFRX function, to do any further processing on the packet. Now, if UMSIM takes care of the networking, it interrupts right at the hard start XMIT function and retrieves the packet data from that kernel, and then it tells the kernel, okay, now you can return from hard start XMIT, you're done. It goes over to the other system, which at that time is idle, and creates the packet there in memory, does all the allocations and all the little metadata adjustments that are necessary for this, and then it calls the NetIFRX function to pass it up into the stack. And UMSIM takes care of all the flow control functions and all those parts. Now, here's the actual flow of a packet when it goes through all of this. First of all, there's the breakpoint at the beginning that initiates all of this. Then UMSIM, the script that actually implements this function, grabs the packet, puts it in a queue that implements the queuing and the transmission delay at the source. Then it sets a timeout until that will pop when the packet is due for sending. When this happens, it takes the packet from the queue, puts it in another queue, the queue that implements the transmission delay over the link. And again, it sets a timeout. And when this one pops, when this timeout is reached, then it takes the packet from the second queue and delivers it at the destination, calling all the functions that are necessary for this in the stack. Now let's put this to some real-life use. There's a little bug in Linux TCP. I think it's still around. We've discovered this about 1 year ago. In TCP, there's a variable called the congestion window, which indicates how many packets can actually be in flight at a given time in the network. And TCP constantly adjusts this congestion window. And when the network gets congested, the assumption is that the network will lose packets. So when there's a packet loss, this indicates now I'm putting too much data into the network. So TCP tries to slow down by reducing this congestion window, by putting less packets into the network. Now, the algorithm for this is that it should cut the congestion window by half when there's a loss. And in the graph here, the congestion window is the red line at the bottom. That's going a zigzag pattern. And there's another variable called the slow start threshold, which is actually sort of which is exactly half the congestion window at its peak, which is the green line at the bottom. So theoretically, the red line should only be reduced to the green line and never below. Now, what happens is that Linux actually cuts the congestion window in half twice in some circumstances. So this makes Linux a bit nicer than it should be to the rest of the users of the network, but unfortunately, it also makes it a bit slower. And notice this is a fairly hairy bug to discover. And what I've done is also to experiment with a possible fix for this, a slightly oversimplified fix, but just to see how things are working, if I'm triggering any new problems. So what I did was that I took the code from the kernel. This is the culprit for this, the TCP congestion window down function. In the middle, you see this command SS threshold divided by 2. Basically, what's happening here is that this function is reducing the congestion window until it reaches the slow start threshold. Now, in the kernel code, it counts down till it reaches half the slow start threshold. The idea is that because the slow start threshold is also halved whenever there's a loss, so the idea behind this is to actually just go down to the new slow start threshold. But unfortunately, it has already been divided by 2, so we don't need to go to half of it, but just to this value. So I made this little change. And as you can see, this looks almost like normal kernel code. The only differences are that there's a local variable, which I've introduced, which is which exists in the original function, but I couldn't use a local auto variable of that function, so I had to create my own variable for this. This is the decrement variable here. So this one gets a dollar sign because it's a variable that exists in the simulation. In a simulation script, also I had to implement the min function, which I couldn't take from anywhere else in the system. But all the rest is the original kernel code, so it's accessing also the pointer to the TCP variable block, TP. And yeah, so my simulation script just puts a breakpoint at the original TCP congestion window down function. When it gets there, it calls the replacement and tells the original function just to go away. Now, here we can see what this does. On the top, you have the bug. This is the same picture as before. And at the bottom, you have it with this modified code. And as you can see, now the congestion window only drops down to the slow start threshold, to the green line, and never below. So this is exactly what it should do. And you can also see that the simulations both transfer 1 megabyte over a simulated network. And in the first case, it takes about 100 seconds. And in the second case, with the bug removed, it takes, well, maybe 87 seconds. So it's in this case, it's also considerably faster. And also, in general, in real life, I would expect that you would see some slight performance improvements if this bug is fixed. Unfortunately, the fix is not quite as easy as this one, because there's another extremely rare and obscure case where now our stack would actually be too aggressive. And if we fix this, then this other problem becomes uncovered. So this is still somewhere in the to-do list, mainly of Alexey Kuznetsov. But eventually, this problem should also get resolved. Okay, so let's see what else is there to do. First of all, there is still a lot of performance work to be done. As I said, UMLSim uses ptrace. Now, if you're familiar with how UML works with ptrace, it's like that. You have the tracing thread, which is kind of being debugged by the debugger. So the ptrace calls going to this tracing thread. And this one then relays it to the actual processes that are running the kernel code. So in order to do this, the tracing thread needs to actually monitor the debugger. Again, it uses ptrace for this. So basically, it turns into a debugger to process the debugger. When the debugger tries to ptrace the UML system, it gets intercepted. And the tracing thread extracts all the data from the system call, kind of forwards it to the actual process that is executing the kernel, and then returns the result, again using ptrace, puts it into a address space of the debugger. So this is a fairly tedious procedure, and let's say if we copy data around, in ptrace you can only copy 4 bytes at a time on a 32-bit architecture. We're using the normal ptrace. And so you do about 10 system calls to move 10 bytes, which is not so nice. So one possibility to speed things up would be to avoid using ptrace. Another possibility would be to implement the ptrace and a kind of an extended read function, which is, for instance, on the Spark architectures, implemented where you can actually move larger blocks of data. Another thing is identifier caching. As I said, UMLSim can use identifiers from the kernel. And unfortunately, well, that but an identifier first depends on the local context. So Let's say in the example before, you had the TP variable. So it really depends on where you actually stopped, what this TP variable. First, you could be in the TCP congestion window down function of kernel A or in kernel B. It could be in a context where this is actually a global variable, not an argument. So UMSM needs to look up variables a lot of times. Even though usually they hardly ever change. So again, there's some potential for caching, and this would make things a lot faster. Another thing is UML has a new functionality called separate kernel address spaces, which improves the switching of address spaces between processes. And this replaces the tracing thread, and this would make UML faster and also UMSIM in turn. But I'm not supporting this yet. For the usability, well, there's the libraries. I can use a few more libraries for other parts than just networking. Also, the libraries are at the moment kind of hackish, so they should be improved. There might even be a potential for writing preprocessors that implement some simpler and more problem-specific simulation languages, and then translate this into the UMSIM language. Something that's also necessary are some visualization tools for networking, for instance, that you get nice graphs, that you don't need to write your Perl scripts all of the time that extract the data. And last but not least, documentation. Well, it's kind of a hacker's project, and it shows particularly in the documentation part. So this needs to be improved. There's also some functionality that can use some improvement. First of all, it would be nice to be able not only to control the kernel, but also the individual processes running inside this kernel. At the moment, you can't put a breakpoint into, let's say, you're running a web server under UML system, and you might want to put a breakpoint somewhere into your web server. You can't do this at the moment. What you can do now is that you can just see, okay, if it's doing the system call, then I'm kind of at the right place. So I'm putting a breakpoint at the system call, I'm waiting there, and when it comes along, then I grab it. This is something you can do, but you cannot really go directly into applications. This would be definitely something that would be nice to have. So this is again for future work. Also, as I mentioned before, trace-driven simulations. You have a system that you're monitoring from the outside. You see what is going into the system, what is coming out of it. Then you take a simulation and feed it with the same data and see if the system what the system does internally. And this might be interesting for exploring what kind of bugs they happen or what some imperfections happen, let's say, in networking stacks, when you cannot really put instrumentation into your system because it would be too slow. So you can have another box that watches from the outside. And yeah, then portability for other architectures in Intel 32 and SMP. And last but not least, GCC's debugging information can get a bit spotty at times. Okay, so acknowledgements. Most of the work on UMSIM was conducted off the FAST project at Caltech, and now it's kind of a hobby project of mine. And quickly to the conclusion, well, things look pretty good. It basically does what it's supposed to do. Also, it's reasonably convenient to use. Performance still needs some work. Usability needs a bit of work. And what I need most at the moment is user feedback, that people tell me where are actually the problem spots, things they'd like to see, this type of things. And you can find all the material, the source code, various papers on it, and talks, including this one, at the UML at the bottom. Okay, we still have some time for questions. Any questions, please? None? Okay, so then thank you very much for your attention.